Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Adaptation by Devon C. Ford. Narrated by John Lee. Prologue.
Absolutely not, Professor, said the man in the grey suit, with a cold finality to his words. He didn't raise his voice, but the intensity was there. No way, no how, no chance whatsoever.
He stabbed an index finger onto the desk to underline his point, in case he hadn't been heard clearly.
No.
But, Professor Sunil Gruel whined, annoyed that the bureaucrats lacked the ability to comprehend that what he was asking for was vital.
Without subjects to conduct the research on, Professor Chambers and I simply won't be able to confirm whether or not the serum works, let alone what side effects it might have on...
He's right,
Chambers agreed reluctantly from the only other chair in the room, which he'd occupied without offering to his colleague. The two men hated one another, or at least Chambers despised Gruel, as he'd been personally responsible for creating the unnatural abomination which had wiped out what he guessed would be more than half of the world by that point.
Without a test subject, a series of test subjects, ideally, we can't be certain of anything.
I'm confused, said the suit who called himself Agent Fisher, as he leaned back at his desk and steepled his fingers.
You assured me that the recipe you cooked up in the lab killed the virus 10 times out of 10. Explain to me how that's now wrong.
It's not wrong, Gruel snapped petulantly. Tests in a petri dish are very different from tests in live host subjects. Already there have been reports of variations in the behavior of some infected subjects, and we aren't even close to beginning to understand or explain why that is. If you'd simply allow us to study a series of captured specimens and...
Study?
The CIA man enunciated coldly.
Captured specimens? Professor Asshole, I'm not sure you fully understand the ramifications of those words, so let me lay it out for you.
He whipped a hand up and snapped his forefinger and thumb together, indicating to Gruel that he should keep his lips firmly together while the man spoke.
Studying a captured specimen means constructing a purpose-built lab with strict control and containment procedures. That holds significant risk to the United States Armed Forces personnel involved in every aspect.
Furthermore, he said loudly, repeating the gesture with his fingers to stop Gruel from interrupting when he saw the opportunity. Capturing those specimens would require missions in hostile territory to return an infectious host subject to U.S. soil and jeopardize those personnel on the mission. Moreover, we would threaten the safety and security of the entire United States by bringing even one of those things back here. So no, Professor, you can't have...
What if we don't have to bring them back here?
Chambers asked quietly from across the office, his eyes staring upwards at the ornate patterns chasing themselves over the ceiling. Gruel and the suit looked in his direction, waiting for the rest of his thought. Chambers leaned forwards in his chair, eyes back on the two men and his hands moving with the words he used to air the idea out loud.
There's a secure military-run base in Britain, right?
He said, waiting for a reluctant nod from the CIA man, who wondered which one of the people at the facility had been talking too much.
So we'd task their military to capture the specimens, and we do the testing over there. That way the whole Atlantic sits between them and whom.
The suit sat back, watching Gruel out of the corner of his eye before turning to fix him with a direct stare and a crooked smile.
I'll run it up the chain of command, he said, pretending that he wasn't a very senior shot caller and not convincing either of the scientists. But I'd say you two need to pack up and get ready to fly to Scotland.
Chapter 1 Squadron Sergeant Major Dean Johnson couldn't sleep. He didn't sleep much at all anymore. He stood in the morning air, the pre-dawn chill tightening his skin and reminding him that he was alive, sipping from a mug of tea as he thought about the day's work to come, exchanging a curt nod of greeting with the evidently cold man standing guard and eagerly awaiting the arrival of his relief. He stared out over the low, rolling landscape, looking inland, over the half-hidden profile of the warrior in place to guard the single approach road. Leaving the hilltop wasn't an issue for him, as the place had never even remotely been home. Home was with his squadron,
and what he had learned via radio from one of the few people of his former life still alive made him feel like a nomad. The crunch of feet on gravel made him stiffen, until he reminded himself that he wasn't in danger, wasn't out in the battleground that was anywhere not protected or fortified against the remnants of the population who had died, yet continued to walk the earth. Turning, he saw the expected sight of Peter stepping in his direction, his small feet treading lightly, as if suggesting the boy had evolved and adapted to this new and brutal world as much as the faster type of screechers had. He gave his young companion a nod, warmer than the one he'd given the sentry, and softened his usually harsh features with a small smile. "Can't sleep either," he muttered in a low voice, sympathetic to the fact that almost everyone else there still slept.
"Never do,"
Peter answered in a tone of voice that made him sound 40 years older than his mere decade. His brow furrowed slightly as he thought about it.
"Didn't before, not really. And finding out about..."
He trailed off as though saying the words out loud would make the knowledge of his sister's survival and subsequent disappearance all too real. Johnson reached out his huge left hand and rested it gently on the nape of the boy's neck, giving him a light squeeze of reassurance in an attempt to convey how he felt. So many emotions ran through him at that moment. He felt a heavy loss for the boy and, if he were honest, for himself. He felt a burning and fierce pride for the sacrifice of the 2 Royal Marines who had held their own long enough to allow him to drive the box van away from their small sanctuary and save the lives of the 2 children and the others. And that pride swelled inside him when he learnt from Daniels that they had made it out alive somehow.
"I know, lad,"
he said, feeling the words to be wholly inadequate, but needing to voice his understanding.
"I know. We won't give up yet, though."
He looked down to meet Peter's eyes with his own.
"You believe me?"
Peter gave a sad smile which seemed to say that he knew Johnson meant the words, but he was just too pessimistic, too broken by the events of the last months, and indeed of all his life before, to allow himself to believe anything good could ever happen again. He let out a long, resigned sigh.
"If she's survived this long,"
the boy said, as he shrugged his shoulders to hide his neck from the cold air,
"then I'm sure she'll manage a little while longer."
Johnson felt a wave of sadness at his words, because he realized they were given to reassure the old soldier and not to provide the child beside him with any form of comfort. The boy's resilience and maturity humbled Johnson. He'd seen more good sense and practicality from him than from many soldiers he'd commanded in his years, and could only imagine what Peter would have become if he'd had a better start in life. If he'd had the opportunities and education which had been wasted on Oliver Palmer, he'd have quite likely become an intelligent and capable leader, like the infuriatingly arrogant second lieutenant's older brother was. Both of those men were gone now, travelled north to Scotland, according to Daniels. He let out his own sigh and wondered if he'd ever meet up with them and the other members of the squadron again.
"I'm sure she will,"
he said quietly, bringing his attention back to the world and the boy's words.
"I'm sure she will."
Peter seemed to shake his own dark mood off in the same moment and rolled his shoulders to stand taller, as though he'd banished the frightened child inside him to his room without dinner.
"When do we go?"
he asked the squadron sergeant major with no squadron.
"We?"
Peter smirked playfully.
"You grown-ups wouldn't last 5 minutes without me and Amber to look after you."
Johnson laughed in spite of his own dark mood and the early hour.
"Oh, if I'd had a squadron of Peters."
"We'll go soon," he said, as he extended a finger towards the partially hidden light armour,
"and we're taking that to be on the safe side."
It was Peter's turn to smile. Despite the collapse of their world, despite the fact that they had been cut off and abandoned, he was still a 10-year-old boy. And what 10-year-old boy didn't want to ride in a tank? Pauline, the apparent leader of the hilltop survivors, wasn't surprised when Johnson had told her they would be leaving soon. She didn't expect such rough soldiery types to sit back and settle, not when there was a water fight, and the news that they would be setting off to link up with their own people and search for Amber's mother and Peter's sister was expected. In some bizarre parody of loved ones setting off for a day's work, she brought them all sandwiches made with thick, fresh bread to sustain them on their search, along with a few insulated flasks of strong sugary tea. The flasks, arrayed inside the warrior, side by side, their tartan decorations looking like some new type of ammunition for the 30mm main gun, provided Johnson with a curious amusement as he maneuvered the big, tracked vehicle out of the widened ditch it had occupied to hide the hull from any approaching enemy. Michaels, one of his former troop sergeants, turned hilltop dictator by all accounts, had still retained enough sanity to ensure the warrior had a full tank of diesel and was loaded with both blue and yellow-tipped ammunition for the autocannon. Johnson sneered suspiciously at the controls for the chain gun, which was widely rumored to be a poor upgrade for their tried-and-tested general-purpose machine guns firing the same ammunition. Still, he told himself, beggars couldn't afford to be choosers, especially when he felt the grunt of the engine through the controls and it bucked free of the ditch, which would have stranded even the most capable off-road truck for an eternity. Being the only man among them accustomed to operating and living inside an armored fighting vehicle, he was forced from his rightful place in the turret and took up residence in the forward hull to drive. Peter, much to his absolute delight, was offered a spot inside the turret alongside Bufford, who Johnson had trained in the basic use of the chain gun. "What about the big bastard?" Buffs asked him, as they sat in intimately close proximity as the commander and gunner would. Johnson patted the breech of the 30mm and shook his head sadly at the sergeant of the special boat service. "You expect me to be able to teach a frogman how to hand-crank an HE round into this and follow up with a clip so as not to get a stoppage and have to start over?" Bufford gave him a withering look, secretly pleased that the comfortable inter-services rivalry had begun to reassert itself. "Just stick to the chain gun," he told him. "You still probably fuck it up, so pay attention, and no coffee breaks," he grumbled, as he fought to maintain a straight face. "I don't want to have to retrain you when you forget it all." Astrid Larson and Kimberly Perkins stepped inside the dark confines of the troop-carrying section, comprising the rear of the warrior, their arms loaded with bags of supplies and weapons. Amber followed, her own backpack stuffed with her favourite things, along with water and food, should she need it. The top of that bag sprouted a threadbare and tired-looking stuffed lamb, which had previously been Peter's sister's, and had been one of his only comforts from the place where he used to live. Not that he called it home, even in his head. It had become Amber's prized possession, not long after he had found her alone and frightened, and she had carried it with her ever since. She also carried Peter's creation, his sticker, as he called it, fashioned originally from a pitchfork, and modified for small hands to wield against the shambling corpses still wandering the landscape. "Zero, Bravo, Zero, Bravo," Johnson said into the radio after they'd said their farewells to the civilians who had shown them kindness. "This is Foxtrot 3-3 Alpha." He waited a beat before the excited voice of Corporal Charlie Daniels came back to him, his usual calm radio demeanor chipped away to release the emotion he felt. 3-3 Alpha, Zero Bravo," he replied in quick words, using the out-of-date rotated call signs which were the last they had been issued. Johnson pressed the button to transmit, but took his finger away again. "Fuck it," he said aloud to himself, unheard by the other two members of their little band inside the tank over the noise of the engine. He pressed to transmit again, this time abandoning the protocols he had spent a lifetime drilling others to adhere to. "Charlie, we're on our way to you now. Get the kettle on, lad. Out." Chapter 2.
"What the bally hell do you mean?"
Second Lieutenant Oliver Simpkins Palmer shrieked obnoxiously at the uniformed but hatless man standing safely on the bow of a ferry 20 paces from land.
"I order you to dock that boat immediately and allow my men and these civilians to board."
The soldier, wearing no obvious badge of rank or indication of his unit, could be heard laughing by everyone on the empty concrete of the Malug ferry port.
"Who's actually in charge?" he yelled back.
"Now you look here," Palmer erupted, his face turning crimson and spittle launching from his mouth on a trajectory like heavy artillery.
His finger was extended, wagging furiously as though the mere threat of the digit would enforce his weak words.
"I'll have you court-martialed and..."
"What seems to be the problem?" a voice asked from behind him, cutting him off and making him suddenly aware of his self-inflicted embarrassment. not only at being denied after a life of entitled ease, but by the shame of losing control of himself.
"Major," Palmer said, composing himself and greeting the man with the genteel nod of an aristocratic bow.
He stepped aside for the tall, bearded Special Air Service officer to lay eyes on his enemy.
"This..."
He waved a frustrated hand in the general direction of the small car ferry.
"Man is refusing my orders to dock and allow us to board. I must insist that you..."
"That you, Tip?"
Major Downs called out.
"It is,"
replied the man testily in a broad Newcastle accent. "I leave you to have a word, boss." He turned away, stepping down from whatever he had stood on to call out his instructions to the officer.
"Lieutenant," Downs said, "perhaps you need to take a minute." The order was made in a polite, suggestive way, which Palmer's education and breeding should have picked up on instantly, but the exhaustion and stress of their long journey by road had robbed him of his decorum.
"Major, I really must insist..."
"Oliver,"
Downs interrupted him angrily,
"you really must stop insisting. In fact, bugger off out of my sight while I talk to a real soldier."
Palmer looked ashen, as if he'd been struck in the face with a dead fish. In truth, he was not the only one to be so exhausted by days of travel under constant threat, and Downs's uncharacteristic outburst served to underline just how strung out they all were. He watched as the young officer moved off, uncertainly at first, but building up to a stomping march, no doubt to find his older brother and make the man's life harder. Downs sighed, wondering how one family could produce two so incredibly different sons. He turned back to the man on the bow of the ferry sitting low in the water.
"Have you been, Tip?"
he asked Corporal Stanley Tipperick of B Squadron, SAS.
"Not too bad and all, considering," he responded dolorously. "Good to see you made it."
"Tell me about it,"
Downs agreed.
"And you too? Still got your boys?"
"I do,"
Downs called back. "It'll take more than this shit to kill off Mac," he added, knowing that a jibe at the hard Scotsman's expense would serve to break whatever ice there was between them.
"I need yous all to follow the instructions to the letter,"
Tip said in a more professional tone, now that the brief pleasantries were out of the way.
"Containment and quarantine?"
"Aye,"
Tip shouted back, waving an arm behind him to some unseen person controlling the boat.
"The Colonel'll fill you in later."
"Colonel?"
Downs asked.
"I thought Major Kelly was in charge here." "Aye, only it's Colonel Kelly now."
"Honestly, the man laughed when I gave him an order. Laughed, and the Major added insult to injury by banishing me so he could speak to..."
"Ollie," Captain Palmer interrupted tiredly, as he rubbed both hands over his stubbled cheeks. "Did it occur to you who the man might be if the Major knew him on sight?" His younger brother recoiled as he always did when he had missed the obvious, his chin retracting so much that it all but disappeared until he regained his composure.
"I don't give a good goddamn who he is,"
the younger brother blurted out, albeit with less gusto than his original complaint. He further betrayed his anxiety when he glanced surreptitiously over both shoulders before continuing his rant in a softer tone.
"I don't care if the man sprouted wings and was anointed by Her Majesty the Bloody Queen. He's a rank-and-file man, and he failed to observe the rule..."
He stopped talking, mouth hanging open in confusion, as his older brother simply walked away with an exasperated shake of his head. Palmer Sr. arrived at the edge of the docks, just as his German counterpart did. Hauptmann Wulff, as characteristically pleased to be alive as he was every day, looked just as tired as Palmer felt, although he somehow made his tiredness seem far more precise, as he did with everything. The two officers fell in step as they approached the SAS Major.
"I rather fear we'll find ourselves interned in some kind of concentration camp,"
Palmer began, his words trailing off as he realized too late the insensitivity of them.
"I suspect,"
Wulff replied without any trace of anger or upset,
"that you are correct."
A smirk began at one corner of his mouth before it spread uncontrollably. "And you should not fear saying such things to a German, Captain. We are just as appalled as you are about the history of our armies, as I think that you are of your own histories, no?" Palmer was saved from having to respond and defend the proud honour of the British Empire, as the Major heard their approach and turned to fill them in on developments.
Small contingent of police, civilian and military, but mostly it's our boys, he informed the two captains. Pretty much all of B Squadron were home when it kicked off, on standby for the terrorism thing and all that. Am I to presume that they will want us quarantined? Palmer asked him.
Yes, Down said. Civvies first. They want 3 loads, so we don't inundate them.
Inundate? Wolf inquired politely but uncertainly. The boys on the island don't want too many of us at once, Palmer explained. Rather than be overwhelmed in quarantine, they prefer that we stay here until they can process us in a more controlled manner, I presume. Downs nodded, taking charge for the first time in the months he and Palmer had known one another. Captain Wolf, he said, earning a click of the man's boot heels to indicate his undivided attention, can you maintain watch on the road and come over on the last boat with my boys and me? The German tank commander's head nodded in a short, sharp bow.
Of course, but I do not see how these...
He held his left arm out, ramrod straight and palm held vertically flat, to point at the small civilian car ferries.
Will possibly transport the weight of our tanks.
And you'd be absolutely right, Downs responded, which is why we're all dismounting and going over on foot. Vehicles stay on this side of the water. Infection risk. Palmer swore that he could have detected the slightest gasp of shock and loss from their ally, and he knew only too keenly how the loss of a man's mount affected him, as he had been forced to leave his own chieftain behind many months before.
I must protest this, Wolf said,
unknowingly repeating the words of the younger Palmer, which had so recently earned him a humiliating retort.
What infection can a machine have? It cannot catch a virus. Why must we leave our tanks?
He trailed off as his eyes followed the outstretched hand of Downs and took in the sight of a matted, crushed slab of blackened meat on the front of the nearest vehicle. White bone jutted out of the mess of gore and rags as an unidentifiable chunk slid slowly away from the metal to hit the ground and make the more grimace at the soft, slapping sound it made.
I understand, Major, Wolf said quietly.
They'll still be here, Downs reassured the man. No creature I've seen yet can figure out the controls on a leopard.
But, Wolf answered softly, I do not like the thought of leaving Edda alone here among the enemy.
Palmer and Downs exchanged a look, both men fighting down the urge to laugh. Palmer's tank had been called Annabelle, and as much as he'd enjoyed the bond with the machine, he hadn't felt the same heartbreak that their friend was evidently feeling.
Edda?
Downs asked quietly, unable to resist.
Ja,
Wolf shot back with a look of challenge in his eyes.
This is the name of my grandmother. It means maiden of battle, like the Valkyries of the North.
His impassioned defense of the name of a tank left both British officers silent for a moment, until Palmer placed a gentle hand on Wolf's shoulder.
Edda will be here when we need her again, he reassured him.
They were saved any further awkwardness as the ferry bumped into the dock gently, emitting a clanging sound loud enough to remind all of them that they weren't exactly safe until they got off the mainland.
Julian, Down said as he turned to Palmer, if you could organize the civilians, send as many of your chaps with them as you can, and the rest are to take the second boat.
Palmer nodded.
What about Mr. Lloyd?
Downs glanced up, taking in their theatre and scanning the assembled mix of people for the Marine officer. Spotting him adjusting a defensive position of a pair of surviving Marines, he satisfied himself that the job of their defence was adequately taken care of. If you could inform the Royal Marines that they will be taking the second transport, the Hauptmann and I will fill the last one. He turned away but snapped his fingers as a thought struck him.
Actually, he said carefully, if you wouldn't mind being on the first one, perhaps the second lieutenant can accompany the remainder of the men?
Palmer swallowed and gave a weak smile of understanding. The shame of his brother's poor attitude and ineptitude at all things soldiering was a blemish on his reputation, but blood was blood, and privately he couldn't stand to hear his brother maligned by so many people.
I'll let him know, Major, he said tonelessly.
All aboard!
Came a soft and distinctively Geordie shout from the sloping dock into the icy water.
One at a time, if you don't mind,
Tipperick said to the nervous civilians as they stretched cramped limbs and stiff backs on the short walk towards the boat.
This way to safety, folks.
Chapter 3.
"What the bleeding hell is she doing?"
Sergeant Bill Hampton asked as he looked out of the window. Marine Enfield, a man who had been unnervingly quiet and still, even before the world burned down and he lost his best friend in a helicopter crash, appeared beside his sergeant soundlessly. Hampton flinched in fright before covering his shock with a string of expletives.
"Shouldn't be out there by herself," Hampton complained, not even wearing a proper coat.
Enfield stared out of the window of the room they shared. The only sound he made, a low whistle of breath through his nose. He watched the girl for a few moments longer, before shrugging and turning away. Neither of them had spoken to the only other people to have arrived separately, apart from themselves, that was, and neither knew how they were so intrinsically linked to one another through their associations. Hampton continued to watch the girl, seeing her breath mist and linger in the heavy cold air, like miniature clouds which hung to mark her progress towards the frosted overhull of the tracked vehicle. Seeing her bang on the side of it and step back, he allowed himself a private smile as the squadron surviving radio man popped out of the hatch to lean way over to accept whatever hot beverage she'd brought him. Charlie Daniels, shivering inside the empty interior of his Sultan command vehicle as the heater powered by the small external generator struggled to fight off the cold, jumped when he heard two bangs on the hull directly behind his head. Too often he'd experienced and subsequently relived the sounds of so many undead hands clawing at the armor like a frustrated cat attacking a sealed tin of tuna, knowing that something tasty hid inside. Taking a few breaths to relax and compose himself, he stood and spun the handle to open the hatch before poking his head and shoulders out.
"Down here," said a small voice.
Daniels leaned over to take in the smiling face of the teenage girl cupping a tin mug in both hands. The content steamed tantalizingly, which told Charlie all he needed to know. Reaching out with a broad smile, he took the drink and thanked her, bringing it to his face to inhale the sweet steam. He wrapped his hands around the mug, his gloves protecting him from the heat of it. At least protecting all but two of his fingers, since he'd cut those two from his glove so he could still manipulate the radio dials. Hot chocolate. With a sigh of satisfaction, he gingerly touched his lips to the drink, only to recoil as the liquid was hotter than lava.
"What you up to?"
the girl asked. "Just waiting for my friend to call up on the radio," he told her, forgetting his very recent injury and foolishly trying the drink again to see if it had cooled down in the last second.
"Can I help?"
Daniels opened his mouth to answer, recognizing that he would actually be glad of the company of someone interested in his secondary profession. But a nagging doubt plucked at the back of his mind. "Do you want to bring someone else to keep you company?" he asked her awkwardly.
"Like who?"
"Like, that woman you turned up with," he tried, listing the only person he knew that she knew, bar the now absent SAS patrol who had found them. Their arrival had sparked another more concerning fear about their security, causing them to face the prospect of risk coming from other people for the first time since the virus had swept over the country.
"She's been in bed for over a week,"
the girl answered, reaching up to grasp the cold metal and placing a boot on it, ready to haul herself up.
"Hold on,"
Daniel said, suddenly seeming worried that the girl was coming aboard regardless of the need for a chaperone.
"What?"
she said, ceasing her climb as she saw no way to scale the high side.
You're worried what people will think if you hang around with a girl my age?"
Daniels looked shocked, but swallowed and nodded.
"Don't be so silly,"
she told him dismissively, and resumed her climbing. "Go round the front," he told her. "You'll never get up this way." He waited as she dropped back down, heard her boot shuffling toward the lower section at the nose of the vehicle until she reappeared on the hull.
"Move over,"
he did, ducking back inside and moving away from the hatch as she lowered herself inside, flailing for purchase with her feet. Eventually, spilling into the Sultan's interior, she straightened her clothing and grinned at Daniels.
"Easy,"
she said, her smile wavering as her teeth chattered. Daniels frowned, glancing around and resting his eyes on a tattered green army smock that he snatched up and went to drape around her shoulders. He froze, leaving the jacket resting over her slim frame as he backed off.
"Relax,"
the girl said.
"I know you don't have any funny ideas."
Daniels relaxed but couldn't help maintaining the frown.
How do you know?
Sample complete. Ready to continue?